Monitor now invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air, winner of every major award in its field. Today's guest on Meet the Press will be Secretary of State Dean Rusk. We'll bring you today's program in a moment.
This is Frank Blair, your Sunday Night Monitor host. Syndicated columnist Earl Wilson is a man who knows his way around New York City. In fact, he's written a book called Earl Wilson's New York. In a recent interview for Monitor, our conversation went like this.
Well, now, what one thing do you consider a must for everyone who visits New York?
Well, I think the greatest free show in town is Greenwich Village, and especially now, with the Weirdos and the Beardos and the espresso places, the outdoor sidewalk cafes, I think, in Greenwich Village, you'll find fascinating.
Well, how do you go about doing Greenwich Village?
If you can hold on to your sense of humor, you should go down there on a Saturday night or Sunday afternoon. You get pushed around a little bit, and you might get exhausted and impatient with human nature, but it'll be fun.
Just a small part of the Sunday Night Monitor scene on NBC Radio.
Somewhere in the world, walking down a lonely street, far from home, there's a young American in uniform. Bored, lonely, feeling half forgotten, then he turns a corner and there's home. The sign says USO. There's friendship, warmth, and the good feeling that people back home care. That feeling happened 21 million times last year. Let's keep that feeling alive. Tell them you care. Give to USO through your United Fund. Remember, USO is there only if you care. And now, Meet the Press. Today's guest, Secretary of State Dean Rusk. Our panel consists of Peter Lissagor of the Chicago Daily News, Stuart Hensley of United Press International, Ellie Abel of NBC News, and John Hightower of the Associated Press. Bryson Rash is our moderator.
Our guest today on Meet the Press is Secretary of State Dean Rusk. We will have the first question now from Mr. Ellie Abel, NBC News.
Mr. Secretary, Senator Goldwater has called for a full, frank revelation of what our basic policy in Vietnam is. He calls it long overdue and asks specifically for the facts of our involvement, if any, in the rioting in Saigon and what he calls the game of musical chairs there. What about that?
Well, in the first place, the policy of the United States in South Vietnam is utterly simple and well known both here and throughout the world. For the past 10 years, we have been engaged in giving assistance, and large assistance, to the government of South Vietnam and to its people to enable them to defend themselves against the aggression from the north represented by these guerrillas called the Viet Cong. That has been a consistent effort for at least a decade. That is our purpose. When that country becomes safe and independent, secure, so that its people can work out their own future for themselves, American military presence will not be required, and South Vietnam can be independent. Now, as far as these recent events are concerned, I've checked the cables today. There is nothing behind the scenes that cuts across or throws a different picture on the reporting, the very extensive reporting that has been coming out of Saigon in the last few days. The Deputy Prime Minister, Mr. Won, has been temporarily put in charge of the government. General Khan is taking a few days rest. Just how long, we don't know.
You do expect him back?
We do expect him back. And the acting prime minister has indicated that he would be coming back and that he remains the prime minister. The demonstrations have subsided in Saigon as they had 2 days ago in Hue and Da Nang and in other centers. What has been happening there has been an attempt to work out on a longer range basis some changes in the constitutional situation along the lines that General Khan has been thinking about and working on for some time. He has wanted to organize a government in which civilian affairs could be more heavily in charge of civilians or under the direction of civilians so that he and the military could give primary attention to the military problems. He has also been trying to organize a more representative group, whether one calls it a national assembly or a legislative council or whatever, that would try to bring about the authentic leadership of the different elements in the population so that he could achieve a greater degree of unity in getting on with the main effort, the war effort.
Then you regard the changes of the last day or two as merely temporary. I take it.
Well, the leaders who are in charge of South Vietnam are the leaders who have been in charge for South Vietnam for the past several months. There has been an adjustment from time to time in the responsibilities of individuals, but we do not see here a change of government in the usual sense.
Senator Goldwater also has charged that this administration has 120 different foreign policies. What's your comment on that, sir?
Well, I think that simply turns upside down a remark which President Johnson made some time ago and which I've made from time to time, and that is that we are dealing in the world with 114 governments that we recognize, plus about another six authorities that we don't recognize as governments, such as Peiping or North Vietnam or North Korea. Each one of those governments and authorities have their own foreign policy. There are 120 different foreign policies in the world. And when the United States, therefore, tries to work out its own foreign policy, it comes up against the fact that there are 120 others making their own foreign policy. This does not mean the United States has, in any sort of flitting sense, 120 different foreign policies. Our principal foreign policy goals are those written in the United Nations Charter, are those contained in our Declaration of Independence. And I think they are very well understood all over the world.
Today's newspapers, Mr. Secretary, or some of them, say that official Washington is optimistic about the possibility of sorting this thing out in Saigon and establishing a more stable regime. Can you tell us what you see in this situation that warrants optimism?
It's a little hard to be a prophet in a matter of this sort, but basically, I think we can say with confidence that we do not see in South Vietnam any group other than the Viet Cong itself, and they're limited in number, who seem to want to turn to Hanoi for their answers. These are people who want to be free, who do not accept the leadership of Hanoi, and who would like to build in South Vietnam their own country. And I think this is the fundamental problem, the fundamental situation. Now, when religious groups have differences with each other, and when there are rivalries of one sort or another within among the South Vietnamese themselves, we look upon these as matters which ought to be put aside until the main issue against the Viet Cong has been resolved. And so this is why we've been urging upon everybody maximum unity and a moratorium on lesser matters until this great national victory over the Viet Cong can be achieved.
We will continue the questions with Mr. Lissacore.
Mr. Secretary, some of the reports from South Vietnam suggest that this is a battle. Some of the instability and unrest is caused because of differences between the Catholics and the Buddhists. And I think you touched on this a moment ago. How much really is there, how much difference is there really between the Buddhists and the Catholics in a religious sense, and how much is it agitation by the communists?
Well, I think it's very hard to be completely accurate about the mix. You'll recall that in the closing period of President Diem's regime, there was considerable controversy and hostility and violence between Catholic and Buddhist groups. In the following period, General Khan has attempted to be a moderating factor between these two groups and to remove religion as an issue. Indeed, in these past several days, Buddhist and Catholic leaders have joined to urge calm and peace upon their respective followers. Now, when demonstrations occur, however, almost any element that tends to divide one from the other might play a role. And I think there has been some tension between some of the Buddhist elements and some of the Catholic elements in these recent ridings. But I gather that in the last few days, it has been found that there had been some infiltration, not only by the Viet Cong, but also by some people with very long criminal records. And certain arrests have been made on that basis. But I do not believe myself that there is any need for extensive hostility between the two religious groups. I think they're moving toward an adjustment of their differences, and their leaders understand the importance of their working together because both of them object to what the Viet Cong are trying to do.
If the South Vietnamese are unable to control the situation in the streets in Saigon, would you foresee the possibility that they might call upon American military personnel to act as a kind of a police force?
No, I think that's not our role. As a matter of fact, when these demonstrations first occurred, about, 4 or 5 days ago, we were told by the government that they did not intend to use force against these demonstrations, but to let them have a period in which they could make their views known. You'll recall that in the first two or three days, the police were there, certain elements of the army were there without arms. Now, when the rioting became more severe, then the police and certain of the armed elements moved in to restore order. But this is not a job for the United States.
Mr. Secretary, in an unstable situation like this, it seems entirely conceivable that a regime might come to power in South Vietnam which would invite the United States to get out. What would we do in that case?
Well, I wouldn't. I don't have any reason to look at that question because we have no impression that there's any significant element in South Vietnam that has that view.
Mr. Hightower?
Mr. Secretary, to follow up on this line of inquiry, do you think the United States may have to take a larger political responsibility if the government crisis in Saigon continues?
Well, I think the basic political responsibility must rest with the South Vietnamese, and our sounding of the opinions of the leaders of the various groups there make it clear to us that they do have fundamentally a common objective insofar as the Viet Cong are concerned. Now, they have differences of view about how the government ought to be organized and who ought to be in particular positions, as among the parties, the military, and Buddhist and Catholic and other elements there. We have no doubt at all about the underlying commitment of all important elements to with respect to the Viet Cong.
I think the thing that worries a lot of people is, how can you carry on a war when there's so much confusion in the government which is primarily responsible?
Well, this is something that we are concerned about. I would say, remind you, however, that during these past several days, the war against the Viet Cong has continued. This has not seemed to affect what's been going on in the field against the guerrillas. There have been 25 to 30 battalions operating every day. There have been some 2,000 small unit actions every day looking for the Viet Cong. There have been 1,000 or more junks searched at sea every day, or maybe 900 or 1,000 air sorties every day. In other words, these problems in Saigon have not yet affected the operations against the Viet Cong in the field.
Some time ago, I'm speaking in terms of weeks, there was quite a lot of discussion about the possibility of broadening the war, escalating the war there. What are the choices available to the United States at the present time?
Well, I think there's no change in that situation. The problem about broadening the war has been discussed many times. Much of this depends upon the other side, depends upon the North. What we are trying to do is to bring Hanoi and Beijing to the necessary decision to leave their southern neighbors alone without a general war if possible. Now, if they continue to press in South Vietnam, then there's going to be a very serious problem ahead of the free world in that situation. But we hope very much that they will see the necessity of leaving their neighbors to the south alone before it comes to that.
In the present circumstances, do you see any possibility at all in the predictable future of making a negotiated settlement?
Well, we have had a negotiated settlement in 1954. We had another one in Laos in 1962. It's hard for me at the moment to envisage just what a negotiation would be about, what speeches the delegates would make when they first sit down at the table. Because if the North is prepared to leave their neighbors in the South alone, then there's no problem. And a negotiation to register that and to work out the consequences would be very simple indeed. Now, if they are determined to continue to press against their neighbors to the south, then I don't quite see how a negotiation can simply pave the way for such aggression. And I don't see how a conference to deal with that subject could do more than break up in a violent disagreement and leave the situation worse than it was before.
Mr. Hensley.
Mr. Secretary, I'd like to broaden the thing into the political field a little more.
Right.
As President Johnson's chief advisor on foreign policy, you obviously are going to have to answer some criticism from the other side. Now, without going into the specifics of what Senator Goldwater may or may have not said about any particular situation, it seems that the general thrust of the Republican argument against the administration is that it is acting with too much timidity, that it is not moving to take advantage of the situation created by the difficulties which Mr. Khrushchev is having at home and abroad. The Republicans imply, and indeed state, that they would take stronger action to exploit situations such as exist in Eastern Europe and Cuba and so forth. What is your answer to that, sir?
Well, I think as far as Southeast Asia and as South Vietnam are concerned, we've got to wait until we see what they really have in mind as they discuss this matter during the course of the campaign. There was a period when some of them were saying on the Republican side that we either ought to get out or to make it into a big war. This is quite a choice, and we don't know what their choice is in that matter. And I'm not at all clear about what Senator Goldwater meant the other day when he talked about a negotiated solution, something that he felt in his bones. I think we need to have those matters trotted out and talked over. I don't myself believe that this great bipartisan policy, which the American people have followed since World War II, needs revision in the interest of greater aggressiveness.
Well, Mr. Secretary, I'm sure you don't feel it needs revision, and the bipartisan policy has been followed since the time of Senator Vandenberg because both parties took the same general approach abroad. But there is a difference this time, I think, in that it is not a question of the outs saying we can do it better than the ins. They say we would do it differently in some instances.
Well, I think that is a matter that ought to be clarified with in great detail in the course of the discussion here in our campaign. Because since World War II, the main lines of American foreign policy have been genuinely bipartisan in character. Aid to Greece and Turkey, the building of the United Nations and support for the United Nations, the Marshall Plan, NATO, our other alliances, the Middle East and Formosa resolutions, the recent resolution on Southeast Asia, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, foreign aid, the expansion of trade, all these great elements of American foreign policy have been based upon a broad bipartisan support. Now, if a choice is being offered over against that basic policy of the post-war period, then we certainly ought to know, and the American people ought to know, what that choice is supposed to be.
Well, to take one specific case where there is indeed something on the record, the Republican Party has said that with respect to Cuba, they would recognize a government in exile to give some sort of focus around which to build resistance, I suppose, and also give all manner of help to guerrillas fighting the Castro regime. They contend that the policy of economic and diplomatic isolation is not really going to work in the long run. I mean, what is your answer to that?
Well, I think that if they were occupying seats of responsibility, they would want to look a little longer at this question of isolation, because that is moving with good effect and with broad agreement among our allies in the hemisphere. This question of recognizing a government in exile is a rather delicate matter in this hemisphere, because the other nations of our own inter-American system are rather sensitive about recognizing governments in exile. So there are some problems there, I think, that they have not really grappled with when they make such statements.
Mr. Abel?
You are a Democrat, Mr. Rusk. You testified before the Platform Committee of the Democratic Convention and gave what seemed to some a rather optimistic view of this administration's achievements in foreign affairs. Do you feel that you have up to now stayed clear of involvement in the campaign?
Oh, I don't think that any Secretary of State can be completely clear of problems that arise in the course of a campaign, because foreign policy is and ought to be thoroughly discussed in the course of the campaign. And I don't suppose anyone would say that under those conditions that the Secretary of State is the only one in the country ought to be silent. But there is another matter which draws me inevitably into the atmosphere of a campaign, and that is that during our own electoral period here, we must continue to carry on our business with other nations. And when something comes along which could affect immediately our relations with other nations, then I must do my best to sort those out. For example, when an implication was made that the President had given authority to our military commanders in the Gulf of Tonkin to use nuclear weapons, I felt we had to clarify that immediately. Otherwise, we would have had dozens of ambassadors in here asking us what was going on. And when the suggestion was made that this hotline was somehow being used to negotiate with the Soviet Union behind the backs of our allies, when I knew, and anyone else could know with a 15-second telephone call, that this is just not so, this had to be straightened out immediately, because this could create suspicions and unnecessary problems with our allies. And so there are points that would come up from time to time where I will have to do my part in keeping the record straight.
You intend, then, to go on speaking out this way when you feel that the basic policy of this country is being misrepresented?
I intend to continue to talk about what our policy is and what we're trying to do against the background of this great bipartisan effort of the post-war period and on specific points that need immediate clarification because of foreign policy considerations in our relations with other countries, then I must move to correct the record.
Mr. Lissagard.
Mr. Secretary, there's some belief there's some support for the belief that the foreign powers, our enemies and sometimes our friends, take advantage of election periods in the United States to do certain things, stir up things in their own interests. Do you share this belief?
Well, I haven't actually seen any instances of that. I think there may be some questions that are temporarily marking time because of our electoral period here. And it may be that some issues will be taken up after the election by foreign governments that they're not taking up at the moment. I don't know exactly which ones those might be. But I haven't had that impression during this period.
Could I take you to Cyprus for a moment?
Yes.
Another one of those hot spots. Is it the American view that the communists are deeply involved in the whole Cypriot trouble, or do we believe this is simply a matter between the Greeks and the Turks on that island?
Well, I think in the first instance, this is overwhelmingly a problem of relationships between the Greek Cypriots and the Turk Cypriots on the island, and this in turn draws in the great difficulty between Greece and Turkey, who feel an interest and a responsibility for their co-nationals, as they see it, on the island of Cyprus.
Do you feel, as some people seem to, that there is a real possibility here of having a kind of Cuba in the eastern Mediterranean, and if so, what would that do to our NATO eastern flank?
Well, one of the reasons why we have ourselves tried through informal and private discussions, tried to find some basis of agreement among the parties, is that we feel that Cyprus and Greece and Turkey and Britain, the four countries primarily concerned, should try to settle this among themselves and not have a situation festering which gives an open invitation to outsiders to interfere and try to fish in troubled waters.
Mr. Hightower.
Another crisis area, Mr. Secretary, is the Congo. To what degree do you have persuasion or evidence that communist China is behind some of the revolutionary activities of tribal groups in the Congo?
Well, we have information that indicates that there has been some Chinese communist interest and a few Chinese communist personnel wandering around in the eastern Congo trying to stir up trouble. We do not believe that in terms of magnitude that this is a substantial problem at the present time, that most of the difficulty lies within the Congo and within Congolese factions and elements and tribes. But nevertheless, we do think that the Chinese communists are trying to find ways in which to fish in those troubled waters as well.
Do you think there's a serious danger that the Congo, in spite of all the UN did there at one point, might still become a major arena of conflict between the United States and the communist side?
There's always that possibility, Mr. Hightower, but this is certainly something that, from the United States' point of view, we should like to avoid. This was why President Eisenhower put this matter before the United Nations, or helped to put it before the United Nations in 1960, and started our policy of backing the United Nations' effort there. This is why we at the present time are very hopeful that when the African states themselves meet, as they apparently are going to meet in early September, they can find an answer for the Congo on an African basis, in discussion among themselves and with the government of the Congo, because here is a great area, as large as the United States, east of the Mississippi, in the heart of Africa. And it would be very important that this area not become a great battlefield of the contending great powers if that could be avoided.
I'd like to return briefly to the subject of bipartisan foreign policy. You've talked about it publicly sometimes, I think this was true in your Philadelphia speech last night, as if you thought there are some issues or some basic positions in foreign policy which should be beyond political debate in this country. Is that true? And if so, what issues do you consider to be in that sacrosanct position?
Well, I don't believe, Mr. Hightower, that there is any issue that ought to be protected from public discussion. But I do think that when there are two great parties, one of whom will be responsible for the White House, and two candidates, one of whom will be president, they should make it very clear as to how they stand on the great commitments of the American people since 1945. I'm thinking about such things as support for the United Nations, attitude toward the control of nuclear weapons, attitude toward our alliances and consultation with our alliances and respect for the views of our allies, and such commitments as foreign aid and all of the other inescapable burdens and tasks that are with us. But I'm not suggesting that there is any public issue that ought not to be publicly discussed. I'm simply saying that those who have or hope to have responsibility ought to clarify their views on those with complete precision.
We have about 30 seconds, Mr. Hensley.
I would like to ask in this 30 seconds how deeply the United States is involved in the Congo, and how much is Chambé's policy of recruitment of white mercenaries going to rub off on us?
Oh, we have, during the United Nations period and to some extent since, provided assistance to the government of the Congo in support of the general policy of supporting the unity and the integrity of the Congo as a country and as a government.
I'm very sorry I'm going to have to interrupt at this time, but our time is up.
Thank you, Bryson Rash. In just a moment, we'll tell you how you can get a copy of this week's Meet the Press interview.
This is Dorothy Gordon speaking. Are all men created equal? Are all men created with equal abilities, with equal creative talents, with equal characteristics? Of course not, you say. Do you agree or not that all men are created with the equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Commissioner George Fowler, chairman of the New York State Commission on Human Rights, discusses these questions with a panel of youth. Check this station for time and day of the Dorothy Gordon Youth Forum.
How healthy is your car? If you're not sure everything is in good shape, better find out soon before trouble strikes. Whether it's the law or not, it's a good idea to be sure your car will respond to driving emergencies. Ask a mechanic to give your car a 10-point checkup. What are the 10 points? According to the National Safety Council, they are brakes, headlights, rear lights, and turn signals, tires, steering and wheel alignment, exhaust system and muffler, windshield wipers, glass, horn, and rear view mirrors. The failure of any of these parts of your car to work as it should can spell an accident whenever you drive. See that your brakes take hold evenly on all wheels. Be sure all your lights work properly. Check the tires for wear and proper inflation. Tighten up the steering wheel if the play exceeds 3 inches. Use live blades on your windshield wiper to avoid the streaks that blur your vision. Baby that buggy of yours for safety's sake. Now, more details on Meet the Press. Today's guest was Secretary of State Dean Rusk. And the panel consisted of John Hightower of the Associated Press, Peter Lissagor of the Chicago Daily News, Stuart Hemsley of United Press International, and Ellie Abel, NBC News. For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamped, self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, M-E-R-K-L-E, Merkle Press, 809 Channing Street, Northeast, Washington, D.C. Meet the Press will be heard again next week at this same time. The guest will be Robert Welch, founder and president of the John Birch Society.
This is Arlene Francis. I'll be with you each weekday morning with Emphasis Women on NBC Radio, starting Labor Day, September 7th.